भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय नमो विष्णुवराय कृष्णप्रस्थाय भूतले श्रीमते भक्तिवेदान्त स्वामी नित्य नामने नमस्ते सरस्वतदेव गौरवाणि प्रचारणे निर्विशेष निवारि पाश्चात्यदेश तरदे श्रीकृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानंद श्री अद्वैत गदाधर शिवासरि गौर भक्तवृंद हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे 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 राम 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 हरे हरे Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 10, Chapter 24, Worshipping Govardhan Hill. Text 3. Pratyatam me pita ko yam sambrahmo va upagata kim phalam kasya vodeshaha kena va sajyate maka katyatame pita koyam sambrahmo va upagata kim phalam kasya vodesha kena va sajyate maka katyatam. Let it be explained to me, Pita, my dear father, what I am, this sambrahma, flurry of activity, upon you, upagata, come, kim, what, phalam, consequence, kasya, for whose, va, and uddesha, sake, kena, by what means, va, and sadyate, is to be accomplished. Makaha, this sacrifice. Translation, Lord Krishna said, my dear father, kindly explain to me what this great endeavor of yours is all about. What is it meant to accomplish? If this is a ritual sacrifice, then for whose satisfaction is it intended? And by what means is it going to be executed? Text 4. Please tell me about it, O Father. I have a great desire to know, and am ready to hear in good faith. Certainly no secrets are to be kept by saintly personalities who see all others as equal to themselves, who have no conception of mine or another's, and who do not consider who is a friend, who is an enemy, and who is neutral. Purport, Lord Krishna's father might have thought that his son was a mere child and thus could not properly question the validity of a Vedic sacrifice. But the Lord's clever statement here would certainly have convinced Nanda that Sri Krishna was making a serious, not a whimsical, inquiry, and that a serious answer should thus be given. Translation, Lord Krishna said, my dear father, kindly explain to me what this great endeavor of yours is all about. What is it meant to accomplish? If this is a ritual sacrifice, then for whose satisfaction is it intended? And by what means is it going to be executed? Please tell me, O Father, I have a great desire to know and am ready to hear in good faith. Certainly no secrets are to be kept by saintly personalities who see all others as equal to themselves, who have no conception of mine or another's, and who do not consider who is a friend, who is an enemy, and who is no trouble. So here Lord Krishna begins to speak, and as the purport indicates, actually his questions are the way he speaks is actually very intelligent. And, of course, as we see and hear the following verses, we see that his questions actually are quite to the point and have behind them a knowledge of Shastra, etc. Now, of course, because Krishna is only a small boy, we do not expect him to have such sharp intelligence. It is not normal that a small child can ask such intelligent questions and also defeat his argument, the arguments of his father, when his father explains about the sacrifice. Yet, of course, we understand this is Krishna, and he is the Supreme Lord, and he knows all of this. At the same time, we also know that Krishna is a small boy in Vrindavan, and all the people there take him as a small child. So it is a little bit incongruous that Krishna speaks so intelligently and philosophically sometimes when he's a small child in Vrindavan. Nevertheless, this is accepted by the people, and they take it as very, very charming that their son can speak so sweetly and so intelligently. Of course, if we look at all the qualities of Krishna mentioned in the, for instance, the 64 qualities mentioned in the Nectar Devotion, many of these qualities are to do with Krishna's intelligence and his speaking ability. For instance, Krishna speaks many languages. He can speak even the language of the animals and all sorts of foreign languages as well. And he also speaks very sweetly when he speaks. It is very, very pleasing. The tone is very sweet. And the, we can say, the expression, how he chooses his words, which words he uses is very nicely. And the whole composition, the sense of what he's saying is presented very, very expertly, very, very nicely. So it's very clear. At the same time, it sounds very intelligent. These are some of the abilities of Krishna. And of course, he is very, very clever in speaking and in persuading others. He can persuade others very nicely. He is very charming when he speaks. And therefore, he can convince people. And at the same time, when he is so clever that by doing one thing or saying one thing, he can indicate so many other things as well. And by his words, of course, he can, sometimes he has double meanings to his words also, so that different people can understand them in different ways. So this is the cleverness of Krishna. So when he's a small child, gradually all of these qualities begin to manifest. Of course, when he's at different ages, he can only manifest certain qualities. So when he's a baby, for instance, babies do not manifest all qualities, so he cannot look so intelligent and so skillful at doing things, etc. But as he grows up, we see that gradually he begins to speak. So this is some of the charm of Krishna. Gradually he develops and he begins to speak some words and then more words, and he puts the words together and he begins to crawl and then he begins to walk, and his skills begin to develop. So when he is in his balya period, basically it's all he's at the mercy of his mother and father more or less for everything, for feeding, whatever, and he cannot speak so well. But when he gets to his Paugandha age, in which he develops relationships with other cowherd boys and they begin to go out and herd the calves, then his intelligence and his beauty begins to increase and increase and increase. And then when he gets to Kishore age, of course, this is the perfection of beauty and skill, etc. All the wonderful qualities, the 64 qualities of Krishna begin to manifest in the Kishore age. And this is considered the most wonderful, beautiful age of Krishna. And of course, Krishna doesn't age beyond that, actually, even though he goes to Mathura and then Dwarka. And then later, when Krishna meets the inhabitants of Vrindavan at Kurukshetra, when they see him, they do not see him as older. He's exactly the same as he was. Same age. And therefore, they identify with him. And when he returns to Vrindavan after killing Dantavakra, he's the same as when he left. He hasn't aged at all, even though it's 100 years later. Same age, Kishore age. And therefore, they identify with him completely. And he goes on continually with his activities as if he never left. Same age.
This age of Kishora especially is very, very attractive. And of course, when he's lifting Govardhan Hill and then after that having Raslita, this is that particular age where all the wonderful qualities manifest. So it is not surprising that Krishna does show wonderful power to speak and intelligence, etc., when he is speaking to his father here just before lifting up Govardhan Hill, because he is reaching his, let's say, his maturity, so to speak, because he's not aged beyond this point. So here, what is he saying here? So he's seeing the preparations for this yajna. It is described here that it is sambrahma. It is, let's say, there's a flurry of activity. Everybody is very, very busy doing so many things. So he says, what is the nature of this thing? Please tell me, what is this? So of course, all children ask questions like this. What is this, mommy? What is that, mommy? What is that? What is that? And they drive the mother crazy at a certain stage by asking about everything. Krishna, in one sense, says this a similar type. Well, what is this you're doing? Please tell me, what is this? But we see that he's actually very intelligent in how he asks this question, because not only what is it, and we get an answer, oh, this is a sacrifice, or this is a dog, or this is a cat, or this is a tree, or this is a cloud, or whatever. And it's a simple answer we'll give to children. And then they say, oh, yes, that is a cloud. It's a little bit more deep, his understanding and his questioning. So therefore he says, what is the result of this activity? What are you trying to achieve by this activity? What is going to happen because of this? Well, that's one thing he asks. And this, of course, is important because for intelligent people, that is, when they grow up, we don't want to waste our activities. Activities should have a result. We don't do anything for nothing. We have to get some benefit from it, whatever it is, whether it's just what we call fun or whatever, leisure for fun, or whether it is studying to get some knowledge or work to get some money. We do everything for some particular purpose, ultimately. So there has to be a phala or a result from all of our activities. Otherwise, we don't do it. It's useless. And of course, if we question our own self about our own activities and ask, well, what is the final result that I want, and what is the result I'm actually going to get? And we compare the things together, sometimes we understand that I'm not going to get that result even though I want it. Therefore, we give up that activity as a useless activity and we try something else. We say, oh, I should do this. And I say, well, I will not be able to achieve this, but this is what I want. Therefore, I should do something else. So intelligently, when we ask, what is the result of this activity, the actual result, what happens when I perform this activity, and we examine closely what the result will be, then sometimes we won't even waste our time in doing that activity. We'll do something else. So it is important to ask this question, what is the actual result? However, unfortunately, because of habit, sometimes we don't ask questions like this, and we simply do activities. And a lot of the activities have become a waste of time because we don't achieve what we actually want. And if actually we look at our whole life, well, see, this is a problem. Now, we do have immediate, okay, I'm doing this because I get this result, this result, this result. But if we look at the long-term result that we want, we sometimes understand, if we examine carefully, we're not going in that direction at all. But the short-term things we're getting, so we go on with the activity anyway. For instance, we work because we get money. Okay, I get the money, I get the money, I get the money. What's the long-term result? What do we do with the money? What is the money for? And so everyone says, but I want to be happy. So I use the money for my happiness. If we examine closely, are you getting the long-term result or not? So everybody works very hard and suffers because they have to work. Everybody gets the money. Everybody spends the money. But still they're not happy. So they get the first result, that is the money, and they purchase things. But they're not happy after all with all the things they get. They may get the house and the car, the television, whatever. But still they're not really happy. So that goal, that phala, the ultimate result of that, what they want, they don't get it. Or they get a little bit of it, and then it disappears. And then try again. So what happens is usually, this is the illusion people fall into by working hard and making money, then I can be happy. And they just go on like life like that. And then at the end of the life, they discover I wasn't happy. And it's too late. You wasted all 40 years of life and you no result. So it is important that we ask that question. What is the actual result of all of this? Why am I doing this? And, of course, asking such questions is also part of spiritual life. Unless we ask questions, we don't even come to spiritual life. And this is one of the questions which leads us to spiritual life when we realize that all my endeavors in this material world are actually hopeless, useless, meaningless. We do them over and over, and we don't accomplish what we want. So we ask the question, and we examine it very carefully, and then we realize that there must be something else. This is not the right thing. But we can't find the answer. So therefore, by the mercy of Krishna, we meet devotees, and then we get answers, and we start spiritual life. Then we get the result. The real follow appears. So such a question has to be asked. What is the actual result of this? What is the result that we want to attain? We have to compare the two things and see if it's going to coincide or not. And if it doesn't, then we give up the activity and we do something else. And at the same time, we have to understand what is the result, the phala. We have to understand long-term result, that this is more important than the short-term result. And we have to see if that long-term result is going to come to us or not. So this requires intelligence. And, of course, we know the human being has intelligence to remember past, present, future, to meditate upon all these events, and to compare things, etc. So this is the ability of man. He can do this. So if we do this properly, then we will come to spiritual life eventually. So this is one of the questions which Krishna very intelligently asked. What is the result of this? So what is the result of a sacrifice, this makka? As we know from the Vedic literatures and Bhagavad Gita, one result, of course, is if we worship devatas, what is the result? Material. We get some material enjoyment. You worship the devatas, and the devatas will be very pleased, and they will bestow all of your desires. This is what Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita chapter 3. In other words, you will get enough to eat. We do the sacrifice, we get the rain grows the crops, and then we harvest the crops and we eat. Or not just food, but anything. Food, water, shelter, everything, goods, whatever. We worship the devatas, and we get results in terms of material comforts for survival and enjoyment. So this is the result. Now, of course, the scriptures, the Vedic literatures, sometimes say that by doing sacrifice, you will get liberation. They even say that. However, we should understand that when this is mentioned, this is not true. When the scriptures say things like this, it is exaggeration, or what we call atistuti, exaggerated praise. And we'll find many examples of that in the scriptures. So we have to be very careful when we read the scriptures. Some of the statements we can quote are not absolutely true, even though it's scripture. And even Krishna does that in Bhagavad Gita. He says the best thing is karma yoga when it's not. It's the best thing you can do. But later he says, no, don't do this. And chapter 3 he says, worship the devatas. Very good. Chapter 9 he says, don't do it. It's foolish. So we have to understand that the scriptures will say things sometimes which aren't absolutely true. They're relative. And we'll see in the Tamasic Puranas, Shiva is God, Shiva is Brahman, or Ganesha is Supreme Brahman. And people will quote this. But then we have to see. Vishnu Purana will say, no, not true. Bhagavatam will say, no, it's not true. They're not Supreme Brahman. Vishnu or Krishna is Supreme Brahman. So then we have to see the contradiction, and then we have to say what is the proper, what is the actual statement which is true, and which is the one which is false. So concerning all of these lesser sadhanas, like karma and jnana and yoga, they will exaggerate. Why? To give their followers faith. And what Krishna say, I give the faith by which people can worship the devatas. So in the scriptures, these scriptures for the lower people, he gives them faith by praising those devatas and saying they're absolute, they're the highest, etc. So that's why we'll see so many people in India have faith in different deities, and they'll even quote scripture to support that. Because it's written in scripture. But then again, we have to see that the scriptures have their application for certain types of people, and we have to see which is the highest truth. So it is only the acharyas that have the ability to see the contradictions and then judge which is the higher truth and which is the highest truth. So that is what the Vaishnavacharyas have done after going through everything. They say, oh, you don't have to reject all of this. This is all karma. This karma is lower than jnana. Jnana is lower than bhakti. And they come to the final truth. So therefore, the karmakanda scriptures will glorify karma. And they'll say, this is absolute. This will give you everything in the material world. This will also give you liberation from the material world. But actually, it's not true. The limit of karma is material world. Enjoyment in the material world and this planet or higher planets. And that's the limit. It will not go beyond that. So therefore, even if the scriptures do say, oh, you get everything. Everything is fulfilled by doing this yajna to Indra. No, it is not. Not true. Okay? The limit is only some material result. That is the phala. And what is the aim of Nanda Maharaj and the people there? So, of course, Nanda Maharaj explains that, yes, we do the sacrifice to Indra because Indra gives the rain, and because of the rain, and then the grass grows, and because the grass grows, then the cows eat the grass. And then our livelihood is that we take care of the cows, and we milk the cows, and then we get the butter and the milk and the ghee, etc. And we can sell this for other goods. And this is how we make a living. We are cowherd people. So that's a material result one gets from this type of worship. So as far as that goes, yes, that's true. That they should do, we can say they should do this worship because they will get material results from it. This is the elementary level of follow. But on a higher level, we know that all the inhabitants of Vrindavan are not material anyway. And they have no material desires also. So what is this? How are they struggling to survive by having to worship devatas and then taking the remnants of the sacrifice and doing all this and surviving by, at the only by the worship of devatas? So actually it's not true. They don't have to do it. They have spiritual bodies. And they don't depend on Indra to give rain or any devata. The senses, you know, have devatas attached to them, etc., to give blessings. So they're not dependent on any of that. They have spiritual bodies. Now, what are they dependent on? Ultimately, only Krishna. Krishna is their life and soul. That is what maintains all the devotees in Vrindavan. He is the very life. If he goes, they're all dead. If he's there, they're full of life. So that actually is what is taught here. The superficial leela is here, and they say all of this, oh yes, we depend on the rain for the crops and the grass, etc., and the cows. That's the external appearance of things. But finally, when it comes down to it, no, they don't have any worry about this at all. They only want Krishna. Their only shelter is Krishna, ultimately. And this will be illustrated in this pastime. Ultimately, they do not care for Indra. And therefore, when Krishna says, okay, don't do the sacrifice, this is all useless because of this reason or that reason, and he gives us Sankhya reasons and logical reasons, etc., and karma, mimamsa reasons even. Things will automatically come anyway, so you don't have to do the sacrifices. So he gives all sorts of arguments. And then Nanda Maharaj agrees. Even though ultimately they're not good arguments because they're based on false shastras, Sankhya and Karma Mimamsa, etc., which are not considered proper. But everybody agrees. Why? Because Krishna said it. Krishna is their life and soul, so whatever Krishna wants, we will do. In spite of the fact that, we should do this because we have to support ourselves. So, their life and soul is Krishna, not the food or the livelihood or the milk or products or whatever like that. Ultimately, they all depend simply on Krishna. And Krishna responds to that also properly. When Indra attacks with his rain and his clouds, etc., then Krishna protects everybody. Krishna acts as a shelter of everybody. And he satisfies everyone. They come to Krishna and says, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? Because, everything is watery now and the cows are miserable. The cows can't eat because there's water everywhere. And we are all cold and miserable too. So what to do? Krishna saves everybody. Krishna maintains their life. And not only he maintains them, but he satisfies them all. Well, how? Because for 7 days, day and night, 24 hours a day, they can look at Krishna without any interruption. And with their particular relationship as mother and father, or as the gopis with Krishna, or the friends with Krishna, they can relish Krishna 24 hours a day. And their eyes become... Of course, eyes are only not just eyes, because the eyes and all the body are one in one sense, that through the eyes, they're able to experience Krishna completely, not just see him. So with the eye, you can not only see, but you can also experience fully with all the senses. So for 24 hours, for 7 days, they have the opportunity to relish Krishna. So in this way, Krishna satisfies their desires and supports their very life by being present before them. So that is the actual what happens here. Anyway, the sacrifice itself, we have to analyze in terms of what is the result it gives. And regular sacrifices in Karmakanda, what do they give? Material results only. Nothing beyond that, even though the scriptures may sometimes exaggerate and say other things. And who is the goal of the sacrifice? We do a sacrifice, and there is some person involved at the end of the sacrifice. That is, who are we worshipping with this sacrifice? Who receives the sacrifice? So, we are, Nanda Maharaj will say, we are worshipping Indra. And that's the direct object of the sacrifice. Indra is the person involved here. However, if we examine very carefully the Vedic literatures, we'll find that ultimately Vishnu is Yajna. As Prabhupada explains in the Bhagavad Gita, Yajna actually means the name of Vishnu. Yajna is Vishnu. Yajna vai Vishnu. That is one of the names of Vishnu. A sacrifice, Yajna. So ultimately, the final beneficiary of all the sacrifices and all the worship is Vishnu. And indirectly, the devatas. In other words, we worship the devatas, and through the devatas, we go to Vishnu. And therefore, in any sacrifice, even if we're worshipping devatas, Vishnu has to be present there also in the sacrifice. And you have to worship Vishnu as supreme. So when Krishna tells Arjuna in Bhagavad Gita that, yes, this is all vidipurvakam, this is not proper to worship the devatas, what that means is it's improper to worship the devatas independently and think, oh, the devata is capable of giving everything to me, therefore I only worship this devata, Indra. That is wrong. However, the scriptures are there, and we follow the scriptures properly, and we worship Indra, we should realize that Indra is only a representative of Vishnu. An ultimate beneficiary there should be Vishnu, not Indra. And Indra, etc., are only representatives. And if we worship Indra like that, as a representative of the Lord, that is vidipurvakam. That is proper worship. So we follow the scripture, and at the same time, it is proper because we recognize Vishnu as the ultimate beneficiary of the sacrifice. So that way you can worship the devata and still not be an aparadi. And you can follow the scripture, and at the same time, get the mercy of Krishna. Huh? So in that sense, if one does karma kanda, one should do it in that way and see that Vishnu is the ultimate beneficiary, not Indra. Huh? So this is that has to be understood. And the other point is that none of this sacrifice or any part of karma kanda has any success, even though you follow all the details, unless one worships Vishnu. If there's no worship of Vishnu there, the sacrifice cannot succeed. Even if you do it at the right time, with the proper mantras, with the proper utensils, and the proper ingredients, with the pure Brahmins, etc. If there's no worship of Vishnu, the result is zero. Somewhere there has to be worship of Vishnu again. Huh? So karma kanda ultimately is dependent on Vishnu also. So that is the actual udesha. Yeah? So here in the sacrifice, everyone is worshipping Indra. Supposed to. Nandamaraj is going to worship Indra. Huh? But Indra is only a representative of Vishnu. Vishnu is a representative of Krishna. So Krishna ultimately said, oh, why do you do all this? You simply worship Govardhan Hill. And then Krishna himself assumed the form of Govardhan Hill so that everyone was actually worshipping Krishna. So Krishna is the ultimate beneficiary of sacrifice, of the sacrifice of Indra, and that's the proper procedure. So anyway, this is important. We have to understand who is the actual beneficiary of the sacrifice, the Udesha. And the actual person is Supreme Lord, not the Devatas. So that is pointed out in this whole lila as well. And the last question, by what means is this going to be executed? How are you going to perform this particular sacrifice? And that question, of course, is important. How are we going to do something? We have an activity we're going to do. We have the result we want, the phala. And who is it for? And then we have the way in which we execute it. If we don't have a proper plan for execution, it's also useless. Huh? You want to get a degree in university, then you have to have a plan of, you got to get the money together, then you have to get the hours so you can study properly and go to the classes and everything. You have to have a proper plan. If you're doing a job, you have to have a proper plan on how you're going to do the job and execute it properly. Otherwise, it doesn't succeed. Huh? So for everything, we have to have proper means of execution. Otherwise, useless also. Which means we have to have intelligence and endeavor to plan things out very nicely. So this is important. Goal is important. Means, proper means is important. And it may not only be intelligence that we need. We also need manpower. We also need materials, whatever, or money or resources. It's all necessary. And if you don't have it, don't do it. Therefore, over-endeavor in devotional service is considered to be an anartha. Huh? This prayasa. Huh? Atyahara prayasa. Over-endeavor for things. Huh? And again, in the nectar devotion, I think what's the 12th or 13th anga is over-endeavor, arambha. Over-endeavoring for material projects. These are considered to be anartha. Not good. Why? Bhaktivinoda analyzes. Because you're too old and you won't be able to do the project, you'll die before it's finished. So what's the use of starting it then? You don't have enough lifespan to complete it, so why do it? That's one consideration. You have to have enough lifespan. Another one, of course, is you have to have enough manpower. Another is you have to have enough money and proper materials. Another is you have to have the intelligence to plan it out properly, to execute it. So all of these things are very, very necessary. Otherwise, why bother with these endeavors? So if everything is available and it's for the purpose of Krishna, then it's not over-endeavor. Then it's allowed. One can have big projects if you have all those ingredients, necessary elements, the means are there. And it's not an over-endeavor, it's not too much effort, but then it can be done. And therefore we see the Goswamis were very simple, and they were living with one cloth, a kopan, and they were eating very simply one dry chapati a day or something, and a little buttermilk, and they were engaged in chanting the holy name all day long, and then reading scriptures and writing books at the order of Lord Chaitanya, and doing parikrama around Vrindavan, and relishing, you know, the pastimes of Krishna and meditation. And yet they also built big temples. They had Radha Govinda temple, a huge temple there. Madan Mohan temple, huge temple. Why? Because it wasn't over endeavor. People volunteered to do it. Okay, let them do it for the glorification of Krishna. So when we say over endeavor, doesn't mean we shouldn't do anything. But if the means are there, then you can do for Krishna. It should not interrupt your devotional service and your progress. So therefore we have to understand what is the means of doing everything. And here, for sacrifice, we know there everything has to be very particular, otherwise you don't get the proper result. So you have to have purity of ingredients of the sacrifice. So some of the ingredients here, they need all sorts of foods, and ghee, and wood, etc. All the things, flowers, all these things have to be there, and they have to be pure. The ingredients have to be there, they have to be pure. Utensils have to be there, in the sense of the proper yajna utensils, the different spoons, and all sorts of spoons they have, ladles and stuff. They have the containers for holding the ghee, etc. Those things have to be ready also. And they need proper qualified people to execute the sacrifice. The cowherd men cannot do that because they're only vaishyas. The expert people are the Brahmins. So they need some expert Brahmins who know all the Vedic mantras and can execute everything very, very nicely. Properly qualified Purohits. Place. They need a pure place. The place has to be purified, and there can be no bones and hair and blood and things around. They have to make a proper place in a proper way. They have to choose the proper time. It should not be afflicted by different doshas like Rahu Kala, etc. It has to be proper time with the proper planets and the proper positions, etc. So all of these things have to be considered in doing the sacrifice. So very, very particular. Everything has to be considered very, very much in detail. And if anything goes wrong in Karmakanda, any detail goes wrong, the whole thing fails. This is the problem with the Karmakanda. One detail is wrong, whole thing fails. So that is why it is not very practical to do in Kali Yuga. On the other hand, we have the chanting of the holy name. Even if everything is wrong, wrong time, wrong place, impurity of people, still has effect. Karmakanda zero effect. Any little thing is wrong. But the chanting of the holy name, Nam Sankirtan, is such that very flexible. You don't have to have proper time. You can do it any time of day and night, any day, any, doesn't matter how the planets are situated. You can do any place, pure, impure place, doesn't matter. You can be impure or pure, doesn't matter. You don't have to be a Brahmin to do it. You can be an outcast and chant the holy name. Remarkable. You don't need any ingredients except your tongue. Only one should have a little faith in the Supreme Lord. That is good. And even if you don't have faith, if you're neutral, even then it has effect. Namabas. The Muslim chanting haram still has effect on him. This is the problem with sacrifice anyway. Even if you do it properly and everything, still, and then one little mistake is there, what's the use? All failure. Big endeavor for nothing, ultimately. So all of these questions should be asked, not only in sacrifice, but in any endeavor. Is it actually worth it doing that, doing this endeavor? So the answer is, if it is spiritual and helpful to devotional service, favorable, and it does not distract you from devotional service, then yes, do it. But where it becomes distracting, and an obstacle to devotional service, and devotional service, of course, is the goal of life, then we have to consider, maybe we shouldn't do this after all. Okay. Any question?
When Prabhupada started the ISKCON, he didn't have manpower, he didn't have money, he didn't have much lifespan. And based on what you said previously, you could criticize him for over-endeavoring.
In a sense, but then what was Prabhupada's goal at that time? When he went there, what did he say? Well, maybe if I make one devotee in the Western world. So he wasn't overly ambitious also. And he was saying, let it be the mercy of Krishna. I will do whatever I can do. And if I make one devotee, I will also consider that a success. But then he also said that, you know, I see in the future so many, you know, temples and whatever like that. So it was a flexible thing for him. So we can say it's a combination of Krishna's mercy and his own desire to simply fulfill the order of his guru and preach to the Western people, etc. And let Krishna do it. If it is, you know, if we don't get huge temples, everything fine. But if it happens, let it happen. Well, I think in all these religions you'll find both groups. You'll find mixtures. Some are interested in the material aspects, some are interested in the spiritual aspects. For instance, in the Lord's Prayer, give us this day the daily bread, etc. That's more like the Karmakanda part. Do pious activities and we get blessings of God and we can live happily in this world. So you'll find that aspect in Christianity. But then you'll find some Christians are more serious than that, and they understand that spiritual love is higher, etc. So that's the bhakti part. And Islam also, you'll find that also. Some sections are saying that the goal is to go to the heavenly planets and enjoy nicely at the oases where there's wonderful date trees and beautiful women and lots of water. And they'll have that. And then the others just surrender to God, etc. is there, and they have a concept of love of God also. So different people will take different aspects of a religion and emphasize that.
The strength of these religions is just like Jagat Masala. The existence of these religions, or the reality of these religions, is simply the Acharya and nothing else. Because it's not from the Vedas. Whatever teachings are presented there, it's not from the Vedas. So, whatever teachings is purely mercy of the Acharya, viewers.
Well, most of it, of course, they do have some scripture like the Bible, which didn't come from any Acharya as such. The Old Testament, and that's also the authority for the Muslims. They take that as their authority also, and secondarily the Quran, but actually it comes from the Old Testament. And that is their authority.
They also have their commentators.
So many things. Both,
yeah. Theology was not at all developed,
actually. Until 500 years later they started writing things.
To justify themselves against others.
Yeah. Even the Gospels weren't written until after Christ disappeared. The Gospels are, I think, written by people who didn't even meet Christ.
I keep hearing that if you chant the Mahamantra and if you remember Krishna at the time of death, that you will avoid the hells.
Yeah.
But actually, isn't it more essential that you're where your mind is, or if you have a heart mind?
What's that?
So some Christians, as you said, can have emphasize that.
Yeah. So simply avoiding hell, that's not the ultimate purpose of us also. That's
also why the practices here, so if you can be repeating the mantras and remembering Krishna at times, you don't behave well,
Of course, when we talk about chanting, it should be pure chanting. Are very sincere chanting. And of course there's different types of chanting. We can chant with material desires also, and you can get those material desires fulfilled, but you don't get the ultimate result, which is Krishna prema. So yes, in bhakti we can have all sorts of mixtures and do that either unconsciously or consciously. It may not be the purest thing, and therefore you don't get the highest thing also because of that, if there's impurity there.
He's asking whether
Well, usually the devotees, not unless they commit great aparadhas, because the strength of bhakti itself, even if it is done imperfectly, is such that Krishna saves you from all those such things. Because Krishna is very affectionate towards devotees of any sort, even mixed devotees, even faulty devotees or whatever. That even he says, you commit sinful activities, still you're my devotee. And name bhakti pranasyati, my devotee is never vanquished. So he does save you, and of course he's saying nap karmanasasti, and then, you know, that you're saved from the worst bhaya, the worst fearful situation of going to a lower animal species or getting hellish punishment. That is provided you don't commit aparadhas and do such things after taking to devotional service. So if there's some sincerity there, generally we can avoid the hellish punishments, etc. But of course that's not our goal anyway. Our goal is simply to develop an attraction for Krishna.
My Bible also they say, thou shalt not kill. Mm-hmm. They say now, thou shalt not kill human beings.
Yeah.
So the Bible also they change in Kali Yuga.
Well, yeah, of course, many changes, of course. But I would think that I think the scholars of the Old Testament will say generally that when it says thou shalt not kill, it is referring only. They will defend themselves and say it's only referring to the human beings because they did sacrifices. Also, they did sacrifices. In the Old Testament, you'll see Isaiah and others are doing sacrifices, and even Abel and Cain did sacrifices also, and one involved animals even. That was second generation after what Adam and Eve. Yeah? They also did sacrifices and killed animals, so yeah, it was permitted within their, you know, so-called religion or whatever, that they did kill the animals. So they will say it only refers to the human being then.
It seems a bit of a conundrum that the Vedas contradict themselves.
Oh, even Bhagavatam will contradict itself in a sense. So the answer to that is, our acharyas say that there's a quotation in the 11th canto. There it says, the rishis are fond of parokshavad, or speaking indirectly or indistinctly. Therefore, they explain, Vishnu Chakravarti and others explain that sometimes we will not get a clear statement of what is happening. Or in a lila, for instance, of Krishna, what is actually happening. Krishna goes away and never comes back for so many years. And when he says, I'm coming back in 2 days, he makes that promise to Nanda Maharaj. He makes the promise to the gopis, and I'm coming back, definitely I'm coming back. And he doesn't come back for so long, so he broke his promise, apparently. But then Vishnu Chakravarti says, cannot be so, because Krishna makes a promise to the highest devotees. He will definitely keep that promise. So therefore, there's another meaning to everything that's happening. Then he explains how Krishna is actually eternally with them. He came back after 2 days, and etc. And he explains that. So says, everything is not explained directly. Higher topics are hidden from people. So therefore, we have to look. And when we find, this contradiction, then we have to say, well, what is the actual conclusion? So when we understand, yes, Krishna should promise, and then he should keep his promise to his devotees. That should be absolute. So therefore, there's a contradiction when Krishna doesn't come back. And then we have to wonder, what is the actual truth? We look for it, and then you'll find some hints at what is actually happening in the Bhagavatam or other scriptures. And Padma Purana, of course, also will say things. So, like that, everything is not stated directly. We'll see in the Upanishads, all very mysterious how they speak. Isopanishad, he walks but he does not walk, he's near but he's far. Contradictory elements right there. How do we explain it logically? So this is there to fool people who are less intelligent, and at the same time make people think a little bit, and those who have great knowledge, then they can explain it properly. They contemplate it and they give us a proper explanation of what it is. So the acharyas, their duty is to solve the contradictions, some of which are very subtle, some of which are quite apparent. And of course, generally we see that everybody agrees Gyan Kanda is superior to Karma Kanda, and therefore Upanishads are considered superior to the Karma Kanda section of the Vedas. So anything that does not support Gyana in Karma Kanda, then we have to reject it. And if Karma Kanda is saying that it's supreme, etc., then we reject that. In the same way with the Puranas, we have the Sattvic, Rajasic, and Tamasic Puranas. And if the Tamasic Purana says something that Durga is supreme, then we cannot accept that. Because Vishnu Purana will say Vishnu is supreme. and sattva is superior to tama and raja. Huh? If they make a statement which is agreeable, fine, we can accept it. If it's contrary, then we don't accept it. Huh?
We are seeing that there are contradictions and we need to analyze it, everything, mm-hmm. to solve this contradiction.
Yeah, yeah.
So how do we make sure that we are not speculating on...
We follow the acharyas, basically.
So ultimately then it comes to the faith, whether we have faith...
No, because the acharyas use intelligence to solve the contradiction. They don't say, oh, it's just like this because I believe it's like this. No, they'll give the reasons. Because this statement says this, this one says this, this scripture has got a higher conclusion than that scripture, therefore we'll take it from this one. They'll give valid reasons for coming to the conclusion they come to. It's not just on faith.
This is why one needs a teacher to study.
Oh, definitely. Too complicated for us to do. We don't know, and there's rules of interpretation. If there is a contradiction, there's just Vedic rules on how you interpret things and where there are contradictions or whatever. This is quite a complex subject, so acharyas have to do that, not us. Very difficult.
Also, the yoga ladder is mentioned. Can you please explain a bit on that? The yoga ladder, where it says that karma kand is lower than the non
vyan.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. That's quite explicitly stated by Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita. Huh? First he talks about karma, yoga, and he says the goal of that is jnana, ultimately. And jnana leads to yoga, asanga yoga, but higher than that is bhakti. Huh? So according to qualification, you can only practice a certain thing. So if you're low qualification, rajagun, you do karma yoga. And then you do nishkama karma yoga and become purified. Then you come to sattva. When you get sattvic, then you do jnana. And when you practice jnana along, then you can do yoga. And after that, then you realize Atma Paramatma, then you have faith, then you do bhakti. So that's the gradual process of going through. But in chapter 12, Krishna says, better than that, you simply do bhakti without going through all these processes.
It's also explained in the Bhagavatam in the sixth canto.
Yeah.
In the beginning of the sixth canto, Maharaj Pritchard inquires. Maharaj, because this world has material world, and at the same time we are holding on to it. So,
why do we hold on to the material world?
Yeah, and we call it, we know this is a material world, still we are holding on to it.
Uh-huh. Why do we hold on to it? Well, we have a desire to enjoy. I want to be happy on my own. I want my own happiness. Basically, this is the problem. And because of that, we get a body, and then the body has its senses, and the senses go out and try to enjoy in the material world. That's... Yeah. Because unless the Atma has a higher experience, it won't have any faith to give up this false attempt at enjoying in the material world. It's risky for it. The Atma to give up this for something else they don't know about. Huh? So therefore we keep on holding on to it out of habit, more or less, from billions of births. Let me do the same thing anyway and try once more. Huh? Didn't work this last time, try again, maybe it'll work this time. That's the attitude of the jiva.
Prabhupada makes a point. Prabhupada quotes Mam Chayobi Abhicharina Bhakti Jogeta Sevita, you know, one just by taking conversational skills, then automatically one will come to the Brahma Buddha place.
Yeah, one's beyond the gunas.
And Prabhupada makes statements, you know, just by taking to devotional service one will be, you know, automatically liberated.
Yeah.
But we see that devotees take devotional service but they're not automatically liberated. In one sense, it's ephemeral, or it's a shadow actually of what devotional service really is.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there's a depth to the statements. If you take the process of devotional service and actually surrender to Krishna and fully absorb,
then you are beyond the goodness. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Vishwanatha Chakravarti makes an interesting statement. He says, even in sadhana bhakti, that sadhana bhakti is also transcendental to the gunas. He says that. And so, well, still, it's only sadhana, we're only practicing to get to perfection. So the idea there is that bhakti in any form is spiritual. And anything spiritual cannot be material. So it has to be transcendental. The only problem is that we're executing it, but we are contaminated, that's all. But the bhakti we're doing is transcendental. It's like the holy name is pure also, but because of our coverings, then it becomes abhas. It is covered. It is, the whole strength is not there because of the covering, so we don't feel it.
That's why we in Mahabhagya were very fortunate, because actually we're not very qualified at all.
Yeah, but we got the highest thing. We got pure bhakti, which is transcendental to the material world, and the holy name, which is transcendental. So, by, of course, by constant contact, then it purifies us.
From Mahabharata, we come to know that Ekalavya was not accepted as a Shishya by Dronacharya. Was it because of Varnashram Dharma, or was it not?
He didn't actually go through Guru. He didn't get permission of his Guru to do what he did and perfect himself.
Dronacharya did accept Ekalavya as his disciple. So what is the reason for Dronacharya not accepting Ekalavya as his disciple?
Well, I think because he, what did he do? He practiced on his own, wasn't it? And he did all independently.
But before that, I think he went to Dronacharya and asked him, I want to become a disciple. And Dronacharya said, no, he can't become a disciple.
So on his own, he did it.
Yeah, and then he went to the forest and he made a statue of Dronacharya. And then
So he's considered aparadi in one sense, because of course he made a statue and worshipped it and whatever, but he actually didn't get the consent of the guru. And of course the guru may or may not accept a disciple.
Is it because of Varnashram?
Well, it's because the guru has a right to see if this person is qualified to get knowledge or not. And if he's an asura or whatever, then definitely he will say, no, you cannot get the knowledge, because you'll misuse it and treat it. That's why for Vedic knowledge in general, it's up to the guru to decide, is this person qualified or not? And it's an oral tradition. And everyone has to go to the guru to get the knowledge of the Vedas. Why? Because unqualified people take it, they misuse it. So the idea of accepting the guru and following his order is always there. And if we try to be more clever and go around him, and even if he refuses, well, we'll make a statue and we'll worship him, and therefore I'm still accepted, then still it's not proper.
Not the right service attitude.
Yeah, you don't accept the decision of the guru, and you're trying to be more clever and get his shakti without him knowing about it or something.
You're doing it yourself.
True. No submission. No pranipat. Or it's an apparent pranipat, because he made a statue and was worshipping it, but ultimately it was not according to the desire of the guru himself. So basically it was his own concoction. Okay.